Chapter 6. He stood there for a moment, just looking at her. He had sprinted at least 12 city blocks at a speed an ordinary man could match only in an automobile, and he wasn't even out of breath. Still, he needed a few moments to collect himself. This was the woman he had dreamed about, the woman who had occupied his thoughts for so long, whose memory, although it wasn't really his, had filled him with such conflicting emotions. He had never met her before, yet he knew what she looked like naked. He knew how she made love. He knew the feeling of her lips on his, although they haven't really been his lips, the warmth of her bare skin, the soft curves of her thighs and buttocks. He knew her mannerisms and he, or a piece of someone else named Jonathan, who was now a part of him, had hurt her. Yet he was a complete stranger to her. Now that he had found her, he didn't quite know what to do. "Excuse me, Miss Barrett!" She looked up at him slowly. She hadn't changed much, he thought. Her dark hair was worn longer now, falling down below her shoulders, and it didn't seem as if she paid much attention to it. She had lost some weight, which made her high cheekbones look even more pronounced. She looked pale and drawn, and her eyes were slightly glassy. She had on some tastefully applied makeup, but it didn't quite conceal the fact that she'd been doing a lot of drinking for some time. The eyes were the dead giveaway. They looked red-rimmed, hollow, empty. She was still a beautiful woman, and she was dressed well in a knee-length, tailored skirt, jacket and blouse with stockings and high heels. But she looked all used up. Still felt powerful emotions welling up within him. His heart went out to her. "Yes," she said, her gaze taking time to focus on him. "Do I know you?"
"No, ma'am, not really. We've never met before. But I know who you are. I'm not trying to annoy you or pick you up or anything, but I'd really appreciate it if I could just talk to you for a few minutes. You see, in a way, a sort of unusual way, we happen to have some things in common."
"What things?" she asked.
"It's a rather long and complicated story," Steele said, "and I'm afraid it might be difficult for you. It has to do with Jonathan."
She blinked and looked away.
"Believe me, I don't want to cause you any pain, but it's important to me. Please?"
She looked back up and stared at him for a long moment.
"Lieutenant Steele?"
He turned to see a couple of young women standing behind him.
Can we have your autograph?"
"Damn," thought Steele. "Perfect timing." He forced a smile and said,
"Sure."
They handed him a couple of cocktail coasters and a pen. He asked their names and signed for them.
"Gee, thanks,"
one of them said. The other one made eyes at him and said,
"Listen, if you're not busy, maybe you'd like to join us for a drink."
"Thank you," Steele started to say. "I'd like to, but..."
"He's busy,"
Donna said. He glanced at her with surprise.
"Well, maybe another time,"
one of the young women said.
"It was really nice meeting you."
"Nice meeting you too," Steele said. "Thank you."
"Please, sit down," said Donna.
He sat down in the booth across from her. Almost immediately, Rick came over personally and asked him if he'd like a drink or something to eat.
"Just coffee, please," said Steele.
"Sure thing, Steele. Coming right up."
"I thought you looked vaguely familiar," Donna said. "I've seen you on the news. You worked with Jonathan?"
"Was he a cop?"
She frowned.
"I thought you said you knew him."
"In a sense, I do," said Steele. "In some ways, I'm very close to him. But we've never met, and up until a short while ago, I couldn't even remember his last name."
She looked confused.
"I don't understand."
"You said you've seen me on the news," said Steele. "How much do you know about me?"
She shrugged.
"I know that you're the famous cyborg who helped avert a military coup. I've seen you on TV, and I've seen your picture in the papers and on the covers of some magazines. Other than that, I don't really know very much about you at all."
"I, on the other hand, know a great deal about you," Steele said. "I know how you broke up with Jonathan Barrett and why. I know you've had a real hard time. I know you have a small birthmark underneath your left breast."
"What on earth do you know that? Jonathan told you?"
"I remember," Steele said.
Rick brought him the coffee and left. Donna frowned again.
"I thought you said we never met, and if you've ever seen me with my shirt off, I should think that I'd remember that."
"In order to explain, I need to tell you a little bit about myself," said Steele. I used to be a Strike Force cop. I managed to annoy my chief once too often, and he volunteered me as a subject for a classified government experiment, something called Project Download. It was an experiment to test brain-computer interface. They implemented a tiny biochip in my brain so that they could have me do certain things and record the process on a computer to see if they could download various types of knowledge and abilities. They can, incidentally. Anyway, the biochip was a permanent implant. Shortly after I participated in the experiment, I went back to active duty and ran into an ambush. I was shot up pretty bad and left for dead inside a burning building. By the time they pulled me out, there wasn't much left of me. I was still alive, just barely, but my injuries were extensive and severe, and I was in a coma with brain damage. Essentially a vegetable. But the biochip was still functioning. So they used it to download my personality, my identity, and store it in a computer. While they repaired my body and made me into a cyborg, they also started working on repairing my personality. Some engram data had been lost due to brain damage, and to compensate for that, they filled it in with some ancillary engram data that they'd recorded on from some other test subjects who participated in the download experiments. Then they installed an artificial brain in my head and programmed it with my human personality. Is this confusing for you?
She shook her head, looking interested.
No, go on.
Well, I woke up feeling the same way I always did, except I was a cyborg. Part man and part machine, with an artificial brain. I had the same identity, the same personality, the same memories. Only the essence of what I had been was once now contained in a cybernetic brain instead of an organic one. That took a bit of getting used to.
God, I should think so,
she said.
In some ways, I'm still not really used to it, said Steele. But that's not all. Not long after I came online, as they call it, I started having dreams. Strange, frightening, inexplicable dreams. Recurring nightmares. One of them, the one I had most often, was about you.
About me?
I've had several different dreams about you. But this one particular dream kept coming back to me. Night after night, I was in a park, having a picnic with my wife and children. Now, I'd been married, I'm divorced now, and my wife's name was Janice. She was a blonde, and had two children, a boy and a girl, Jason and Corey, teenagers. My daughter was... She died recently.
I heard about that. I'm sorry.
Anyway, Steele continued, there weren't the people in my dreams. In my dream, the children weren't Jason and Corey. I didn't know who they were. They were smaller, younger, twin boys and a girl. And in the dream, my wife wasn't a blonde. She was a brunette. And her name wasn't Janice. It was Donna.
Donna Barrett was staring at him with a stunned expression.
I was playing with the children when suddenly a screamer appeared and attacked them. There was nothing I could do to stop it. I don't know why, but in the dream, I couldn't seem to move. You were screaming hysterically. Stop!
Hissed Donna. She closed her eyes. Her lower lip was trembling.
For God's sake, please stop!
Steele stopped. He hated putting her through this, but there was just no other way. After a moment, she opened her eyes and looked at him with a dazed expression.
How could you possibly know about that?
She asked.
At first, I didn't know, said Steele. I couldn't account for it. I couldn't understand it. I had other dreams about you. One of them took place right here. In this bar. In this very booth. We were here together. You were crying because I just told you that I was leaving you.
She was shaking her head slowly, barely perceptibly, and was staring at him with a stricken expression.
My God! You were dreaming my life!
No, said Steele gently. Not your life. Jonathan's. I couldn't understand it. It was driving me crazy. I thought maybe I was losing my mind.
He paused.
Maybe I am. Because, you see, what happened was when they used that ancillary data to fill out my engram matrix, my identity, to compensate for the brain damage, they used engram data from other test subjects that they'd worked with. It was only supposed to compensate for function loss, but it did much more. It became a part of my subconscious, a part of me. I was remembering bits and pieces of other people's lives. I was having memories of experiences I never actually had, but in a way, I did have them because they had become a part of me, part of my identity. Jonathan Barrett wasn't the only one, but his personality fragment is the strongest. You must have had been one of the test subjects in the download experiments. They used recordings of some of his mental engrams to repair me. Parts of Jonathan are now a part of me. He's like a ghost inside my mind. And until this moment, so are you.
She said nothing. She just continued staring at him as if she'd seen a ghost, thought Steele.
I don't know if I can explain this to you, Steele said, but I have to try. You see, I knew you weren't my wife. I knew I never met you, but I knew you. I felt connected to you, and I couldn't help it. This may sound crazy, but I felt as if you really were my wife, as if your children were our children. And after the tragic thing that happened...
He paused.
I'm sorry. I know this can't be easy for you. But you see, I lost my entire family in exactly the same way.
Her eyes were damp.
You did?
She said softly.
My mother was a nurse, said Steele. I was just a kid then. She was working with some doctors who were trying to find a cure for virus 3, and she got infected by a sample of contaminated blood. It must have happened very quickly. She was already a screamer when she got home. I had two younger brothers, about the same age as your twins were when it happened, and she attacked them. She didn't know what she was doing, of course. She was hopelessly insane. By the time my father got to them, she'd already infected them. She attacked him, and they struggled, and my dad broke a chair over her back and stunned her. Then he got out his .45 and shot her.
My God!
Steele nodded.
I was petrified. I couldn't move until that shot. When he fired the gun, I screamed. I wanted to just run to him, but he yelled at me to stay away. He never yelled at me like that before. He wasn't angry. He was scared. See, he'd become infected too, and he knew he didn't have much time. He told me that I'd have to be brave and be a man, and that he hoped someday I'd understand what he was about to do. He said after he did it, I had to call the police and explain to them what had happened, and under no circumstances to touch them or come near them. And then he called my brothers over. They were crying. And he hugged them and kissed them and told them to turn around, and then he shot them both quickly. One bullet through at the back of each head. Then he stuck the gun into his own mouth and blew his brains out.
Oh, Jesus, Donna said. And you saw it all?
Steele nodded. He hadn't touched his coffee. She hadn't touched her drink.
How old were you?
She asked.
16, said Steele. Anyway, in the dream, it was my mother who attacked our children, your children. And it wasn't Jonathan who was there, but me. And I just stood there, helpless, unable to do anything. Just the way I had been when my mom attacked my brothers.
That's what Jonathan did, said Donna softly. He didn't do anything.
She looked away.
Only he didn't just stand there. He ran away. The screamer who attacked our children was a woman. An old woman. I know they're very strong when they're like that, but she was an old woman. And Jonathan just ran away. I was the one who drove her off.
You?
Said Steele. She wasn't looking at him.
I just went crazy. I picked up the picnic basket and started hitting her with it. Swinging it with all my might. Just screaming at her and hitting her and hitting her until she took off.
You could have been killed, said Steele.
I didn't care. She was hurting my children.
Donna swallowed hard. She seemed to be staring at something beyond the brick walls, if she could see through it.
After she ran off, Jonathan came back and said we had to take the kids to the hospital right away. He didn't say anything else at all until we got there. He didn't even look at me. And when we got there, these men, they were dressed all in padding, like those people who work with attack dogs. They took the children, and I realized what they were going to do. I knew they had no choice, and I know that it was better for them to die that way than to be like...
She looked back at Steele, and he saw the tears streaming down their cheeks.
He ran away,
she said in a hollow voice.
He just ran away.
So that's why he left you,
Steele said quietly.
He couldn't take the guilt.
Say, excuse me, I hate to interrupt, but aren't you Donovan Steele, the cyborg?
Steele looked up to see a man standing by the table. He had no idea how long he'd been there.
Please, he said. Not now.
Yeah, I told my buddies it was you. Listen, it would be great if we could tell the guys back in the office that we arm wrestled with you. How about it?
Look, fella, give me a break, will you? I'm having a private conversation here.
Hey, come on, it'll only take a minute. What do you say?
Let's get out of here, said Donna, reaching for her purse.
Oh, come on, man, don't leave. It'll only take a minute.
I'm sorry,
Steele said, getting up.
Check, please,
Donna said to a passing waitress.
Oh, no, the waitress said. It's all taken care of. Any friend of Steele's.
Steele took out his wallet and dropped a 10 onto the table.
Hey, how about it, Steele? What do you say?
Take me out of here,
said Donna.
Oh, come on, sister. You got all night with him. Nothing that won't wait a minute, right?
He winked at Steele. Steele grabbed him by the shirt front. His eyes glowed red as his laser designator switched in.
The lady wants to leave, he said. And you're being a real pain in the ass.
The man paled.
Hey, okay, no problem. Take it easy.
He released the man and headed for the door with Donna.
Jesus Christ,
the man said, swallowing hard. His eyes followed Steele as he went out the door, and then he glanced back around at everybody in the bar. They were all looking at him.
Did you see that, man? When you try to be all friendly and the guy almost takes your head off. What an asshole!
You're the asshole, friend,
said Rick from behind the bar.
Man's got a right to privacy, and you were bothering him and the lady. Now do me a favor and leave, okay? Forget the check. Just don't come back.
She wasn't at the lab or in her office. She'd left for the day. There was no answer at her apartment either. And on the 9th or 10th ring, Higgins realized where she would be. She wasn't the type to run and hide. They were alike in that respect. Both aggressive. Both implacable. Both relentless. Both people who took the bull by the horns and wrestled it to the ground, come hell or high water. She was waiting for him in the living room of his apartment. She'd let herself in with her key. Higgins noticed that she'd had a few drinks. A half-empty glass and a bottle of scotch stood on the coffee table by the couch. She stood up as he came in, a determined expression on her face. Higgins' own face was white with stone-cold fury.
What have you done?
What I had to do,
she answered calmly. Half a bottle of whiskey, but her voice was steady and her eyes were clear.
Why?
We couldn't go on like this, she said in a level tone. We lost control. Steele is acting erratically. What happened to Stalker is probably already happening to him.
God damn it, you don't know that!
If I had waited until I knew it for sure, it would probably be too late,
she replied.
I'm chief engineer on this project, and I have my responsibilities. He's refused to come in and have his programming debugged, and now he's refusing to come in at all. He simply disappeared, and no one has any idea where he is. It's probably already started. Then there's the Matrix. It's doing the same thing. It's disintegrating, just like Steele is. It's not sane, Oliver. It's threatened you. It's threatened us. And your answer to that was to knuckle into its demands. Demands of a computer program, for God's sakes. And then order me to therapy with Dev Cooper. As if I was the one with the problem. Jesus, Jennifer. I did that for your sake. And I was going to see Cooper, too. We've both been under a lot of strain, and I needed to be sure we were making the right decisions. I'd already started seeing him. Wonderful, she said flatly. Did he give you a critique of our sex life?
Higgins stared at her with astonishment.
I can't believe it, he said, stunned. That's what it's really all about, isn't it? The Matrix taped us while we were screwing, and Dev Cooper caught a brief glimpse of it, and now they've got to pay. Is that it?
Don't be crude, she said with distaste.
Crude? Crude! My God, do you even realize what you've done? You've ruined his life. He's probably going to go to prison. And maybe I will too.
You're not going to go to prison, she said, as if patiently explaining to a child.
That was part of the deal I made with Carmen.
Deal?
What?
Deal? In exchange for my cooperating with the committee and giving him that statement, he's promised to give you nothing more than an official reprimand and keep Download intact after he shuts down Project Steel. It'll be transferred to Los Alamos, and I'll be made director of the project.
It'll be just like we talked about when you thought you were going to shut down the project and disband the agency. We'll leave this lousy city and move to New Mexico, where you can breathe fresh air and see trees instead of filthy, crumbling buildings. And we can have a decent life together. A good life. Well, that's just great, Higgins said with disbelief. And what about Dev Cooper? I don't know why you're being so concerned about him, she said flatly. It was Dev Cooper who brought all this down on us. If it hadn't been for him, we wouldn't have this problem with the Matrix. And he's not only refused to cooperate in having Steele's programming debugged, he violated regulations by stealing highly classified data. I'm at a loss to understand why you're being so protective of him. If it had been anybody else, you would have had them arrested. Higgins shook his head in amazement. You've got it all figured out, haven't you? He said. You've got it all neatly rationalized away. The Matrix is an insane computer program that has to be destroyed. And Cooper is a criminal who has to be punished just because they caught you with your pants off. You're being ridiculous. And what about Steele? What's he done to you? He's out there, afraid to come in because he thinks he might be losing it. He doesn't know about the Matrix, so he has no way of knowing that he wasn't hearing things, that it really was his own voice on the phone. There's probably nothing wrong with him at all, only he doesn't know that. Except now, thanks to you, only they're going to hunt him down and try to kill him. And for what? Because he wouldn't let you play around with his software? Because you resent him for being able to have an open relationship with a former hooker while you, the distinguished and respected scientist, have to sneak around to play your kinky sex games behind closed doors? God forbid anyone should find out that you like to get your legs up in the air like any other woman. I'm not going to react to that. You're just angry because I took control of the situation and went over your head, said Jennifer. If you think about it clearly for a moment, you'll realize that I was right and that I did what I did because it was necessary, not because I was trying to threaten your masculinity. And I did it for you, Oliver. It was all coming apart. If I hadn't gone to Carmen when I did, your head would have been on the chopping block along with mine. I worked all my life to get to where I am today. I wasn't about to let it and watch see both my career and yours go down the drain simply because some misguided loyalties and your male ego wouldn't allow you to admit that some serious mistakes had been made. I did it for us, Oliver. There is no us anymore, said Higgins, staring at her as if he were seeing her for the first time. Really seeing her. You killed it, Jennifer, along with everything else I've worked so hard to achieve. But you didn't even understand that, do you? You really don't. You've got it all worked out so that everything dovetails neatly in your twisted logic. You're being melodramatic, she said. Melodramatic! You've just destroyed two men, Jennifer. And you've destroyed me, too. I trusted you. I loved you. And in one fell swoop, you took the project away from me, gave Carmen what he needs to have the agency disbanded, sent Dev Cooper to prison, and condemned Steele to death. Melodramatic? Jesus, melodramatic doesn't even come close. You're a ruthless, terrifying, cold-hearted fucking bitch. And it makes my blood run cold to think I've been inside you. She stiffened. You're only striking out at me because your pride's been hurt. You're incapable of being objective about this right now. I did the only thing I could do to try to salvage everything we've worked for. But if trying to hurt my feelings is going to help you get out of your system, then... Hurt your feelings? Higgins said with disbelief. My God! Get out, Jennifer. Get out before I lose what little self-control I've got left. All right, she said. If that's what you really want, I'll leave. We'll talk about this after you've had a chance to calm down and think this over. But I want you to know that you're not being very fair to me. If you were really honest with yourself, you'd see that taking your frustration out on me is... Higgins lunged at her and grabbed her by the throat with both hands. He spun her around and forced her backwards as she clawed at his hands and made choking sounds. He slammed her back against the door, hard, then pulled her back, flung open the door and shoved her out into the hallway, hard enough to send her sprawling. She fell to the floor and stayed there, clutching at her throat and coughing, gasping hoarsely for breath. "Get out of my sight," said Higgins, "because so help me God, if I ever lay eyes on you again, I'll fucking kill you." He slammed the door shut and leaned back against it, shutting his eyes and breathing deeply, trying to get himself back under control, fighting a powerful urge to go after her and make good on his threat. After a moment, his breathing slowed and he went over to the coffee table, picked up the bottle of scotch and took a long pull on it. Then he drew his arm back and threw the bottle against the wall with all his might. He put his hand up to his forehead and held it there, fingers pressing in against his temples as if to counteract the pressure from inside that threatened to build up and explode. Then he took another deep breath and exhaled it slowly. "No, goddammit," he said through gritted teeth. "I ain't fucking rolling over on this. Not by a long shot." He snatched up the phone and punched out Deb Cooper's number. It was a tiny apartment, a railroad flat laid out in a succession of three rooms, while the entrance leading into a small kitchen with ancient and battered appliances and a small wood table with two chairs. A short hallway that was little more than a walk-through closet led to another small room that she had turned into a sort of den with bookshelves and a writing desk, with a bathroom in the corner no larger than a closet, just barely enough room to accommodate the toilet, sink, and bathtub with a shower head. Off the den, there was a living room with a well-worn and faded throw rug on the floor, a few more bookshelves, a fireplace, a couple of chairs, a couch of the type that unfolded into a bed, a reading lamp, and an old stained and scratched-up coffee table. The bookshelves were nothing more than boards placed across stacks of bricks. They were crammed with a profusion of old hardcovers and aging paperbacks. The living room had the apartment's only windows, but they had been boarded up. The boards looked fairly heavy, and there were cross braces hammered into them on the inside. The place wasn't much different from the ramshackle apartments found in No Man's Land, except she had power and running water. And though it was hardly what anyone would call luxurious or even very comfortable, it was neat and tidy. None of it was out of place. "It's not much, but it's home," said Donna with a self-deprecating shrug. "Would you like a drink?"
"If it's no trouble."
"No trouble at all. I haven't got much in the way of food, but booze I've got. Scotch all right?"
"Scotch would be fine."
"I don't have any soda."
"I take it neat."
She got out a bottle and two glasses.
"You know, it just occurred to me. What happens when you drink?"
"Nothing much," said Steele. "I can't get drunk. I don't have to worry about damaging any brain cells. Though if I drank enough, I suppose I could screw up my liver."
"So what's the point? If you can't even get a buzz, I mean."
"I don't drink to get drunk."
"No, I do."
She sat down on the couch beside him and filled their glasses.
"Cheers."
They drank.
"I'm sorry about what happened back there," Steele said.
"I suppose it comes with being famous,"
she said.
"I didn't mean that," he said. "I mean about making you cry."
"I haven't been able to cry in a long time," she said. "It helps, you know."
"I know. I can't do it."
"A lot of men can't."
"No, I mean I'm physically incapable of crying. My eyes are biomimic optic units."
She stared at them. She hadn't seen it when his laser designator switched in back at the bar.
"They look perfectly normal."
"Most of me does," he said. "A lot of me is. But then, a lot of me isn't, either."
"What parts are? I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude."
"It's all right. What parts are artificial, you mean? My brain, of course. My skull is made of nice steel. Both my arms and legs, my ears, my eyes, my jaw and teeth. My skeletal system is either nice steel or reinforced with nice steel. The skin over most of my body is a polymer compound that's bullet resistant."
She touched his hand.
"It feels like ordinary skin," she said.
"Yeah," he said. "They're pretty good at that."
"Can you feel that?"
she said, running her finger along the back of his hand.
"Yep, microsensors. I'm state of the art."
She turned his hand over.
"What's that?"
she asked, pointing to the circular indentation in his palm.
"Gunport, retractable 10mm semi-automatic pistol. I've got a carbon laser in the other one,"
he said, holding up his other hand.
"You're sitting here with a walking arsenal. Make you feel nervous?"
She shook her head.
"How does it make you feel?
Strange, he said. Sometimes I don't feel human. I'm not sure if I am.
You seem very human to me, she said softly. If you weren't, I don't think you could feel about things the way you do.
I'm not even sure about that, said Steele. You heard about what happened to the second cyborg that they built? The one called Stalker?
She nodded.
He used to be my partner, Steele said. His name was Mick Taylor. He's the one who introduced me to my ex-wife.
He paused. Was it dangerous for him to be alone with her? She seemed to be all right now, but how could he be sure?
He went insane. I'm not sure the same thing's not happening to me.
Because of the dreams, you mean? Your memories about me?
Jonathan's memories?
No, she said. Your memories. Maybe you got them from Jonathan, but they're yours now. Ours,
she added softly.
You're nothing like him.
Would it bother you to tell me about him?
No, not anymore.
What is he like?
Was,
she said.
I'm sorry.
He's dead.
I didn't know.
He killed himself about a year ago. God, has it been a year? He worked for the government. He was a programmer.
You mean he worked on the project?
Steele said, stunned that Jonathan could have been so close.
I'm not really sure what he did, she said.
She shrugged.
Something at the federal building. He said it was classified. He couldn't talk about it. He kept a lot of things bottled up inside. He was a good man, but he wasn't very strong. It was probably my fault he died.
How is it your fault?
I blamed him for what happened to the children,
she said dully.
For running away and not doing anything to stop it. After it happened, I had a breakdown. They kept me in a hospital for a while. He tried to come and see me, but I said I didn't want to see him, and they wouldn't let him in. I found out later he was sleeping with my sister. Maybe he did it because he was lonely and depressed. Maybe he did it to get back at me. I don't know. Maybe it had been going on for much longer than I thought. With Trudy, anything was possible.
Steele suddenly had an image of a girl about 5 years younger than Donna and bearing a strong resemblance to her, but with a more stubborn, willful expression, a sultry, pouting mouth, and a rebellious, challenging look about the eyes.
Shortly after I came home from the hospital, she said, he moved out. I guess I knew then that he was going to leave me. I drove him away. I was a constant reminder to him of what had happened, of how he had panicked and ran away, abandoning his children. I guess he couldn't live with that.
That doesn't make it your fault, said Steele.
It's my fault that I couldn't forgive him and try to help him through it. I loved him, but I couldn't forgive him.
Can you forgive yourself? Asked Steele.
She looked up at him and blinked.
You didn't do anything, Donna, Steele said. You were a victim of a terrible tragedy. Things like that happen, but they're not anybody's fault. Hell, it wasn't even the Screamer's fault. The Screamer was a victim too. Life can be really hard sometimes, brutally hard. But that doesn't mean you have to find someone to blame for it, or blame yourself because you could have done things differently. That's got nothing to do with reality. Reality is what happened. It's what is, not what might have been. I guess Jonathan didn't really understand that. He didn't solve anything by killing himself. He just passed the buck, like a little boy saying, "Look what you made me do." Crawling into a bottle won't solve anything either. It won't make the pain go away. It might keep you from feeling it for a while, but it'll still be there when you get sober, and then you'll just have to get drunk again to hide from it. Only you can't hide from yourself. The way to deal with pain, Donna, is to allow yourself to feel it. Pain is one of the things that makes us human, that lets us know we're alive. It's all right to hurt.
It's hard, she said,
a single tear started a track down her cheek.
I know, he said. But it's harder if you hide from it. Believe me, I know. I've been there.
She reached out and gently touched his cheek. Then suddenly she was sobbing. Great, wailing, racking sobs that shook her entire body. Steele put his arms around her and she buried her head in his shoulder as all her repressed grief finally broke through.
It's okay, he said, stroking her hair gently. Just let it out. Let it all out.
She cried for what seemed like a long time, then finally she started to quiet down. The floodgates had burst, and the grief and pain had all flowed out. And now there was only a trickle left. For a while, they simply held each other as she cried softly. Then she pulled away and looked at him. She brought her face to his and kissed him. He could taste the salt of her tears.
"Donna," he said, "I'm not Jonathan."
"I know," she said. "It's not Jonathan I want."
And then she kissed him again. They sank back down onto the couch. End of chapter.